Hey guys, how's things? Good, good. Welcome back to the show from last week. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hope y'all had a good weekend. Oh wait, it's Tuesday already. Hope you had a good yesterday. Why was I thinking it was Monday just now? I don't know. It's not, though. It's Tuesday, god dang it. And today's show, I'm going to interview a guy whose brother got murdered by the cops the other day. Got him rad. Well, you know, the cop didn't want to get blood on him. And the guy had some blood on him. So the cop figured the best thing to do would just be to take his life away by shooting him to death. It's the kind of thing that would be a crime if anybody else did it, but he's a cop, and so it's perfectly fine. Because in America, there's no such thing as law. Just the will of men. And so, well, he's got a badge, so that means he's got the will of, I don't know what, 50 million co-conspirator fellow government employees on his side. And they got each other's back. Yeah. Well, anyway, so we're going to talk with him. This is an obvious case of pure murder. Guy had his hands up. Wearing no shirt. Shorts, I think. Obviously not armed. But, ew, I don't want to touch him. He's blood. He got blood, so... Here's a bullet through your heart. That's what they call law enforcement in America. The cop is guilty until proven innocent. Know why? Because his victim is innocent until proven guilty. So if his victim is innocent and the cop killed him, well, then the cop must be guilty. And the burden of proof is on him to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that he's not an evil, guilty murderer. I presume that he got out of his car saying, oh, great, a chance to murder somebody. This is going to be perfect. Right? Because I presume his victim innocent. That's how it works. Yep. And then Mike Swanson's going to be on to talk a little bit about the empire and the business cycle and where we're at in it right now. And, you know, Mike Swanson, he does the advice thing. I mean, he talks about what he's doing, Wall Street Window. He explains, here's what I'm doing. Here's what I think is happening, and here's why I'm doing this, that, and the other thing with the money I got. So he'll be explaining it, you know, from that kind of point of view, how you can protect yourself from the coming correction. Yeah. Lucky for me, I don't have any money. So when the next crash comes, I'll lose just as much as when the last crash happened and the one before that. Meh, this is the same difference to me. I still make just barely enough to be able to call out Amoro in Egypt. So that you can hear it on the show from time to time. All right. And now I'm realizing I should have read more than half of this thing. I'm going to have to cram during the commercial break. Yeah. All right, so today's the day. There are 83 to 14 to limit debates and amendments. I'm not exactly sure what they're doing. They're passing the USA Freedom Act. I don't know if they're, I guess it's pretty certain they're not going to have Rand Paul's amendments. But, well, that's funny. There's a Cotton and Paul voting together on this. So I guess this is to stop all amendments, including McConnell's, but also Paul's, right? Anyway. So there you go. Life without the Patriot Act. It lasted 2 days. They're going to reauthorize it today, sort of, kind of. Now, the USA Freedom Act is not exactly the Patriot Act, but yeah, pretty damn much. As Marcy Wheeler has shown... over the last, 10 months or more, something like that. Yeah, they'd gone in and they screwed with the Freedom Act to make a joke out of it. Now, the Patriot Act, they called it that always as a cynical exploitation to terrify every congressman into better line up and vote for it kind of a thing. The USA Freedom Act, I think they sort of kind of actually meant well with that. They were saying, you know what? Snowden has shown us that our government has been lying and violating our rights and lying about violating our rights. And I think, yeah, geez, Sensenbrenner, the congressman who helped usher the Patriot Act through, calls himself the author of it. It was really the Department of Justice wrote the damn thing. But he said, listen, we went over 215. And 215, you know, Section 215 of the Patriot Act never said what they claimed it said. Never authorized mass surveillance. They call it bulk collection because that sounds better than mass surveillance of the American people. And so, hey, let's do this Freedom Act to fix it. Well, then all they did was, guess what? Fix the Freedom Act until the point where it's damn near the Patriot Act again right now. And what they're going to do is they're going to have the phone companies. They're going to mandate that the phone companies keep all the records forever. And then the cops will come and look at it when they feel like it. I don't know whether they're going to even need a FISA warrant. I guess not. To come and look at it. And then also Marcy has shown us they have all these loopholes now with the hops. Where now they can have more hops here and more hops there than they used to have before. And I don't pretend to understand all the damn details of it. But I know that when Marcy Wheeler called out the ACLU and said, hey man, this ain't much of an improvement. They went from endorsing it to backing off that endorsement. As she explained on the show yesterday, they're neutral now. They're no longer supporting it. That ought to give you a clue. But anyway, you know what? I think it's a huge symbolic victory. It's the first real rollback of the post-9/11 police state. And it's still only a partial one. But it does go to show that, well, I don't know. I don't know if it really goes to show this. It might go to show that, you know, hey, maybe the American people could roll this stuff back if they really, really wanted to. I'm not saying I believe in the efficacy of the system as it is. But, you know, as Ron Paul says, even in the Soviet Union, ultimately the people got what they wanted. They wanted an end to Soviet totalitarianism, and so it just kind of fell apart. Doesn't necessarily have to be all about lining up the votes. Hell, look at what's going on with the drug war right now. I mean, on one hand, could you believe it's gotten this far? But on the other hand, those of us who understood this issue well have wondered all along, how can we go on like this? But like this meant where everybody who's not either, you know, a cop or on the payroll or a damn fool is saying, this is crazy that we continue this policy. The black markets create the violence. The black markets create the high prices. The black markets create excuses for the cops to violate the rights of every single one of us. And why are we doing this? And yet for decades still, you never hear talk like that on TV. You know, basically ever. Maybe in terms of pot, but never in terms of other drugs at all. And you just couldn't find a Republican or a Democrat running for office anywhere who would say that, yeah, the drug war has gotten out of control. It's more harm than drug abuse itself. So, come on. It was just, God, it seemed like it was, like the Soviet Union, seemed like it was never going to damn fall down, you know? The drug war, and I'm not saying it's over yet, but I'm saying at least now we can have a honest discussion about it in the mainstream, not on the fringes, but in the mainstream, they've got to talk about this now. These kinds of things have changed. So it could be that just overall, it makes sense and it's very clear and the consensus is, and it's the left and the right and the South and the North and the Midwesterners and the Californians and everybody else that, you know what? We want to repeal all this crap. We don't want a Department of Homeland Security anymore. We don't want any of the Patriot Act anymore. We want a return to normalcy and an end to the empire. If enough of us could agree about that, we could make it happen. You know, maybe. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X Key Score, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the off-now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, you guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. Hey, be like me. Join up the chat room. Hey, guys, how's it going? There's the chat room. So, I got a call out to the George Soros office because did you see this story? Hacked emails expose George Soros as Ukraine puppet master. That's what it says, a Zero Hedge. The story comes from Russia Today. They say that these hackers broke into the email of President Poroshenko, and they found all this stuff, and including from Soros. I haven't read all through it all or whatever, but large amounts of money being discussed, $15 billion here and there. But now, so, at the bottom of one of these PDFs, it says George Soros's office is in, has the address and telephone number. So I called the telephone number and asked for comment. And they put me off, and then they put me in touch with a guy named Michael something. I have the audio here, although there's not much to it. It's just him non-denialing it. Well, you know, I haven't seen it yet. We haven't had time to go through it yet. At first he was mad because he thought I was the other Scott Horton, who apparently he knows. But I don't really sound like the other Scott Horton. So he realized very quickly that I was a different Scott Horton, but then so he acted all suspicious-like and this and that. So I says, you know, who cares if I'm from antiwar.com or what, man? Just it's a yes or no question. Are they legitimate emails or not? Is this made-up stuff or these are actual emails from George Soros? Oh, that, you know, we haven't even gotten a chance to go through them and make sure yet. Really? Because there's not much here, I don't think. So, anyway. Put that in your, non-denial, half a get-back-to-you denial. He promised to get back to me. He's going to get back to me. And let me know. So, yeah. I got, he's got my cell phone number, so I guess if he calls back, I can answer it and hold the speakerphone up to the mic, and it'll be close enough. You know, it won't be really good, but you'll hear it. Oh, cool, man. So, Dice is going to be on. Yeah, dude. Let's see. So. Yeah. Skype. 1:30 Eastern. Okay, cool, man. So add Jeff Dice to the list today. So we got Mike Swanson on the money. We got Gautam Arad on the cops, murder of his brother. And Jeff Dice is going to be on to talk about the Silk Road and the prosecution, conviction, and sentencing of Ross Ulbricht. And now, I haven't done nearly a good enough job. Actually, I haven't done any job whatsoever in covering this story. I barely read about it, but Deist has a new one about it, and, it'll be running on Lou Rockwell tomorrow. And, the guy got sentenced to life in prison. And, you know, I think they said something about how, well, you know, he tried to take out a hit on somebody. Well, that's a problem, but is that what he was charged with? Was taking out a hit on somebody? And if that was just an undercover cop, then is that a life sentence? When it was never going to happen kind of thing, you know what I mean? Interesting. All right. Yeah, I got too many tabs open here. Let me plow through some of this. Again, in case you missed it, fatal police shootings in 2015 approaching 400 nationwide. The Washington Post has decided that this is a story they want to pursue. They're going to try to keep track of all the police shootings in America this year. And then this is from the Broward Palm. It's BrowardPalmBeach.com. The Broward Palm Beach New Times. That's BrowardPalmBeach.com. Cops cleared in shooting of 73-year-old security guard who called 911 for help. September 2012, Earl David Brown, 73, was securing the grounds of a recycling facility where he'd worked for the past 35 years when he reportedly noticed a prowler on the grounds. Brown called the Lauderhill Police Department for assistance. When the cops arrived, they saw Brown, who was armed, and shot him. Oh yeah, I'm sure he pointed the gun right at the cops, right? He was trying to kill those cops. That's why the security guard called 911. It was an ambush, right, grand jury? Right, prosecutor who told the grand jury, look, I don't want to prosecute this case. And they said, okay, I don't care. Don't. You know, the grand jury is made up of all government employees anyway. Former cops and prosecutors and wives of cops. Those are the worst kind of people in the world. And so, how is this not a murder charge? What if another security guard from the company had showed up and shot him? He'd be charged with murder. He'd be charged with murder. Well, I don't know. I guess it depends on the security guard company, right? They have a lot of government contracts. He might be treated as an honorary pig for a day, like George Zimmerman. You're an honorary pig for a day. Don't worry, you got sovereign immunity. But the guy killed was a security guard too, so that means he was like at least a third of a human being compared to a government employee, right? Doesn't he have any rights to not be killed if he's a security guard, which is like sort of kind of doing the job that the cops don't do because security isn't really their job? Wouldn't it be nice to be a fly on the wall in that grand jury room? How did they come up with tough? Anyway. And then check this one out. NBC caught altering interview with witness. Guy's coming around the corner. He sees the local TV interviewing the murder witness. Oh, this is the one we're about to talk about. Then he watches the news that night to see how they edited it. And sure enough, he's got the clip of the guy saying, yeah, he was walking like this, and he kind of imitates him sort of shuffling slowly with his hands straight up. And then in the clip, they cut it to somebody else's voice, but they cut the frame away, the visual shot away too, so you are led to believe it's the same witness continuing to speak and saying, yeah, he was really aggressive. Yeah, that's not what he said. Here's the footage of the unedited video. He doesn't even imply a threat. So, if you're a killer cop, don't worry. NBC in LA, they got your back, dude. Because they're liars. Oh, and get this. They did a red team of the TSA. 95% of guns and explosives got through. 67 out of 70 tests failed. Hands up. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is Gada Morad. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Well, I appreciate you joining us on the show. Everybody, I saw this clip. A friend on Twitter sent me this story this morning. It's at photographyisnotacrime.com. NBC caught altering interview with witness to fit police narrative in Long Beach police slaying of student. That student being your brother, Ferris. Am I saying his name right?
It's Faraz.
Faraz, okay. Could you please, first of all, just tell us about your brother?
Well, he was 20 years old. He got accepted to Berkeley and UCLA. He decided to go to Long Beach because he wanted to save money for law school. He was brilliant. He was a speech and debate coach at El Camino Real High School, and he was a national ranked debater. He had a 3.9 GPA. He actually wanted to be the president of the United States when he grew up. I honestly think he could do it. He could have. He was a genius. He was really smart, and I can't believe this actually happened to him.
Well, I'm so sorry that it did. It's just absolutely terrible. Can you take us through the story? Explain how it is that he even got in front of a cop's gun in the first place?
Well, on May 27th, he went to practice. He went to practice a speech and debate tournament with his friends, and he decided to have fun, and he got the wrong idea of fun, so he took shrooms with his friends for the first time. He's never done drugs in his life, and it's not like it's like a abnormal thing. A lot of like teenagers and like a lot of people have just tried it before, and I know he didn't expect anything like this to happen. He got really confused and dizzy, and he started acting really like confused and weird. And he was with two of his friends, and they were trying to stop him from moving around. So he had jumped out of a two-story building. He jumped out of a two-story window. And his friends called an ambulance, and he just was really confused, and he was walking around just dizzy. And the police officer thought my brother was a threat, and he shot him three times, and I also heard four times. They didn't try to cuff him or anything. They didn't try anything. They just went for the gun, and that's how he ended up in front of a police officer's gun. He didn't even really. 1 second, my mom's calling me. Hold on.
Yeah, go ahead. So his friends called for help. They called an ambulance for help, and instead the cops showed up with a gun. And now, it says here, it's photographyisnotacrime.com. They have this story, and this is just a side note. you know, compared to what, you know, the real consequences of what happened here. But
I'm editing the
witness statement here. Yeah, no problem. I'm filling time talking to the audience here about the way they edited the witness statement here.
There's a lot of lies on the internet. My brother wasn't acting violent at all. He wouldn't hurt a fly. He was really, like, everyone around him, there was witnesses that said my brother wasn't acting violent at all. He, in general, even if he was on every drug in the world, which he wasn't, he wouldn't hurt anyone. He doesn't have that kind of mindset. Nothing can, like, go into his mind to, like, get any anger out. Even when he looks angry, he doesn't look, like, even when he, like, you know, when you put your eyebrows together and you look mad, he doesn't look mad. He just looks, like, I don't know, confused. He just, his face is too kind to look angry. He would never, like, be able to, he can't scare anyone. He wasn't, like, strong enough to hurt anyone. He doesn't look like he's strong enough to hurt anyone anyway.
Yeah.
He was unarmed. He didn't have anything with him. And his friends kept yelling at the police officers that he was unarmed.
Well, yeah, and it says here that he was not wearing a shirt and was unarmed.
And he was bleeding from head to toe from the fall from the window. And I'm sure he had, like, trauma, like, his brain, he was probably, maybe he was bleeding, like, inside his head. He fell from a two-story window. He doesn't look like he can hurt anyone.
Well, and, you know, the way the witness, the edited statement, again, we talked about this a little bit in the earlier segment, where a guy was coming around the corner and saw the local news recording an interview with the witness, and he decided he wanted to compare and contrast the whole interview with the edited version on TV that night. And sure enough, they went and edited his statement and cut it to somebody else's statement, trying to make it sound like, you know, putting the word, oh, yeah, it was very aggressive in this one guy's mouth, when he was actually describing an entirely different thing. And he actually mimics Faraz and puts his hands straight up in the air. I mean, not just kind of up, bent at the elbows, but straight up. And kind of mimics him slowly shuffling forward. And then he emphasizes the amount of blood. It almost sounds like the cop just shot him because he didn't want to have to touch him because he was so bloody from the fall, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm just, that's just my supposition, but it seemed like, you know, obviously there's no threat. If he's got no shirt on, then it's plain to see
he's
got no gun in his waistband or anything like that. He's got no machete in his hands, like they're claiming this morning. Another killing.
He has no muscles or anything, actually. He doesn't look like he can even hurt. He barely looks like he can pick up a box full of, like, books. He looks like, I mean, I'm not saying he looks weak. He just doesn't look like he can fight anyone and hurt anyone.
The thing is, too, that, you know what, even if he, and I understand what you're saying about his appearance, but even if he was having the worst mushroom trip in the world and had hit his head so hard that he was just completely in a daze and flipping out and maybe even attempting to take a swing at the cop, or maybe it could have possibly looked like he was going to or something. If we give them that much, you still don't get to kill him for that. A cop ought to be able to win a fist fight.
Yeah, exactly.
But he didn't even try.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Now, so what are the other cops saying? Are they, you know, pretending to take this seriously and giving him 2 weeks paid vacation here?
You know what? The police officers, the hospital, the coroner's office didn't call my family when my brother died. He died on Wednesday, and I found out on Friday through a Facebook message and a call.
They didn't call your mother or anything?
They didn't call anyone. I found out because my brother wasn't answering the phone. He was supposed to eat dinner with us the day before, and he wasn't answering, and we got worried. So I contacted his friend, and I called his friend, and his friend told me that my brother was dead. They still haven't called us. They never said anything. And they told his friends that they were going to contact us, and they never contacted us. My brother was dead. He's been dead since Wednesday, and I've been at school having fun, and I didn't know that whole time my brother was dead.
Oh, man. I'm so sorry that this happened. That is just absolutely terrible, God. I'm so sorry. Listen, so are you guys, do you have a lawyer? Are you trying to press charges and file complaints
and
do everything you can?
Yeah, we have a lawyer. Mm-hmm. We're going to press charges for sure. this is, we want to put a stop to police brutality. It's like, it's been happening too much. There's been, actually, there's been four police shootings. They killed four people in Long Beach, the police, in these past, I think, four or six months, I'm not sure, but they, last month on April 23rd, there was a 19-year-old boy who was shot for vandalism.
Yeah, well, it's between two and three a day.
I'm not sure if this is true, but I heard his mom was watching. I'm not 100% sure, though.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, there's this will be no consolation to you at all or anything, but there's a guy in Wisconsin who the cops killed his son in his front yard for no good reason other than they had a chance to, I guess. And what he did was he got a law passed, and it's not a cure-all or anything like that, but what it does is it mandates that some official from another jurisdiction has to be included in the investigation. And I think that's probably about halfway to what we should really be trying to push for would be, and, you know, call it Ferris's law, Ferris's law. I'm sorry, I'm saying his name wrong. Ferris's law, that it has to be a prosecutor from another jurisdiction within the state who does these reviews, and that the prosecutors who rely on the cops that they're investigating are no longer allowed ever to look into these. It has to be somebody else within the state. You know, it won't change the whole world overnight or anything like that, but what's happening now is they know that there's no accountability. So they're all just looking for a chance to escalate a situation, for a chance to kill somebody. Because it's fun, mm-hmm. if you're a killer, to kill people. And so they have to have a counter incentive, which is they could go to prison for the rest of their life. Right now, they are mm-hmm. not in fear of that because there's no chance of it. And so, mm-hmm. you know, I try to bring that up as much as I can because I imagine you're going to be involved in this kind of activism now for a long, long time because of what they've done mm-hmm. to your family here. And it just seems mm-hmm. like, you know, I try to encourage people to keep the eye on the ball here about, you know, what could possibly actually make a change other than just demanding that they be nicer. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'm sorry. I'm more yelling at you than interviewing you here, but I don't know what to ask anymore other than, you know, to just please understand that there are a lot of people out here that are with you, feel very bad for you for what happened here. You know, if you do end up, you know, kind of working on this in the future, not just this case or even, you know, any further developments in this case or any further activism that you do along these lines, I do hope that you'll keep in contact with me and for that matter, I really hope you do get involved in, you know, the Free Thought Project, Photography is Not a Crime, Cop Block, and all those great groups that are doing so much great work on these issues because, you know, that's the only way to make a change here.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I'm sorry for lecturing you so much. I really appreciate you coming on the show, Gata, and I'm very sorry about what's happened here again.
Thank you. All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, guys, that's Gata Morad. Her brother, Ferris, was murdered by the cops last week. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
Man, unreal. Wish I'd known better questions to ask her instead of just talking to her so much, instead of asking her questions so much. But yeah, man, Americans, man, they just love cops. Kind of no matter what, right? Is that the rule that you love cops until they kill your brother?
And then you go, whoa, wait a minute. I'm starting to think that maybe this whole cops killing whoever they feel like, whenever they feel like a thing, has gone too far. I'm not accusing her of that. I'm just saying, you know, people in general, just love them. Hey, look at Faraz's friends called 911 to help him. To help him? Guys, this ain't a TV show. When you call for help, they're not going to send a helper. They're going to send a cop who's looking for a chance to kill somebody. That's who they're going to send. And I'm sorry, I know it's not supposed to be that way. You think? But that is the way it is. Now, I admit, I called 911 when I walked right into a robbery, and it was 2-on-1. And that girl was so butt ugly, I swear to God, I thought it was two guys. I was looking at the guy with the giant club in his hand, who was hitting the old man over the head with it. If I'd known it was a guy and a girl, I guess I probably would have got my ass beat with that club too, but I would have tried to intervene, you know, I guess. I like to think. Man, was she ugly, dude. They told me later it was a guy and a girl. I was like, what? No, it wasn't. It was two dudes, man. Well, anyway, I called the cops on that one. And, you know, luckily they didn't show up and just shoot me, right? Well, where's the robber? He got away. Got to shoot somebody, so here's the witness. It's a real danger. But that was a real emergency. I mean, the guy's head was, his skull was split open. There was like bright orange-ish red blood pouring out of his brain, dude. I had to call 911. He could have died. And yeah, it was an armed robbery thing, so somebody's got to get this guy, and I don't have a gun, and he's got away, and I'm going to try to take care of the old man's head here and put some pressure on this bleeding. And but damn, man. You know, I don't know. And I guess in this case, this guy had fallen out of the window and was apparently bleeding really bad, so he needed an ambulance. They shouldn't have mentioned that he was on shrooms. They probably mentioned the shrooms to the dispatcher. That's what got the cops out there. And, you know, I don't know, man. I had a bad trip on shrooms once, but it just put me in a real negative mood was all. I didn't go nutso. I have seen people go completely nutso from eating too much shrooms, though. I'll admit that. I mean, there's a limit to how much you're supposed to eat at a time, guys, you know? Anyway. Yeah, even the Washington Post, get it, confirmation bias? Even the Washington Post is saying that they're killing between 2 and 3 people a day, you know? Like a nuclear family, 2.3 children. The cops kill 2.3 people a day in this country, which is actually a miracle considering that there are more than 100 SWAT raids a day. More than 100 SWAT raids per day in America, the land of the free. Yeah, right. The land of the cops and the SWAT raid. So, you know, the fact that they only kill a couple of people a day is incredible. Especially considering most of these guys get up in the morning just dying for a chance to finally take somebody's life again. Because it was so much fun the last time they killed somebody. And I'm tired of people saying, nuh-uh, that's not true. Yeah, it is too true. Give me a break. You think that cops really believe that everybody's trying to kill them? They know that's not true. They're looking, and this is in the words of a Ferguson cop who wrote it up again in the Washington Post, as official as it gets. Everybody on the force but me and my partner, I'll tell you what, we're great. But the rest of them, they look for an excuse to escalate. And shoot. In every situation they're in, what could I do to turn this thing into a thing where I could pretend to plausibly say I was afraid and had no choice? He's got a knife. Yeah, but he's laying down in bed and you're 50 feet away from him. Whatever, dude. He had a knife. Oh, he reached for his waistband. Ah, come on. He was a black guy with sagging pants. He was reaching for his belt to pull his pants up because he was running away. Whatever, dude. Waistband. Waistband! Your Honor. Hey. Ladies and gentlemen of the grand jury. The cop swears that the guy was reaching for his waistband. No, Bill. License to kill. That'll teach you people to go around wearing pants. No waistbands for you. Here in this case, the guy was wearing no shirt. Hands up. Clearly did not have a gun in his waistband. They said on the call, presumably right, he's having a bad trip. Not he's on PCP and he's gonna tear you limb from limb, little cop. Just, he's having a bad trip. He's kind of flipping out. He fell out the damn window. He hit his head. He needs a hand. Maybe he needs somebody to give him a good stiff elbow and knock his ass down and handcuff him just to hold him still so that the EMTs can save him. Maybe that's the case. But how in the world does anyone excuse putting a bullet through his heart? How does anyone in the world excuse that? Other than he's a cop, he can kill whoever he wants. Cops can kill whoever they want. This is communist China. It's your job to crawl around on the ground and beg the cop to kill you if he feels like it. Right? Because the government created us, and they own us, and the only rights we have are the rights that they decide to give us, and they can take them away whenever they feel like, and there's no accountability whatsoever. Tell me where I got a word wrong in that. But anyway, I hope you get real excited the next time they take a big American flag out on the ball field. I hope you encourage your son to treat that flag like a religious symbol. That flag and the government and the Nazi jackboot stormtroopers of death that it deploys, they're what make us free, boy. Now take off your hat and put it over your heart, because in our family, we love the government way more than Jesus or Yahweh or a sacred cow or any other thing that somebody might worship. In America, we love the government that kills us, the government that imprisons more people than the communist Chinese government does, and they've got more well over, they got what, 2/3 again our population, right? We've got 300 million people. They've got more than 1 billion. And America has more people in prison than in communist dictatorship, electionless China. And, you know, whatever. The cops can kill your little sister just as easy as Barack Obama can kill Anwar Awlaki. And there's the exact same amount of accountability. None. None. And, you know, it's funny because you look at this thing at the Washington Post. Fatal police shootings in 2015 approaching 400 nationwide. And they go, you know, a lot of these people were armed with, you know, something. A gun or a knife or a machete or a vehicle or, in one case, a nail gun. Oh, a nail gun, huh? He was pointing the nail gun at the cop and shooting it. I don't believe that. I mean, I guess it's possible, but I don't believe that. But you understand the premise here that, well, hey, if they have a gun, then their life is forfeit. If you have a gun or a knife, then you're dead. Is that the law in America? I thought we got the right to bear arms like never before in America. I thought there were more. I thought in every single state now, it's legal to carry a concealed firearm. Am I wrong? And in almost all the states, you can carry one on your hip, too. Because this is America. Like the security guard that got shot. Well, he had a gun. Well, he's a security guard. Well, whatever. He goes in the statistic of armed people shot by the cops. Guess he had it coming. Don't worry about him. Oh, except he was white, so does that count? Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support the Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
I do not care about soccer, okay? I don't care about the worst soccer scandal. I just don't care. Please stop talking about soccer, everybody. I don't want to care. And I know part of it has to do with because of the Israelis and what. I still don't care. All right, anyway. On to our next guest. It's my good friend and yours, Mike Swanson from WallStreetWindow.com, where he gives you a window view into what he's doing with his money so that if you think he's smart and makes good decisions, you can pattern your behavior after his and make money, protect your assets too. Also, he's the writer of the great book, The War State. America? Yeah. The War State, and it's about the early post-war era. Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, how they built up the national security state and also fought to limit it. And their successes and failures and all that great history there. I think you should read that book. Okay. Welcome back to the show, Mike. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, very happy to have you on. So you sent out your monthly newsletter here. It's titled, When Will the Next Bear Market Start? And I thought that I'm very interested in this, not because I have any money, but just because, I blame the central bank for all the booms and busts, and, I blame the warfare state for the central bank and vice versa at the same time. And, so it's, this is all about, you know, the price of killing Iraqis in my eyes. And I think, and I'd like other people to kind of see the connection there as well. But at the same time, I also would like for, you know, the people in my audience to have a chance to protect what money they do have from the depredations of the central state and their allies. And so if there's a bear market coming and you think they need a warning, well, then I want to give you a chance to give it to them. So I guess just how bullish is the stock market now, and what does that portend for the bear?
First of all, I think you're right, what you're saying about the connection of the Fed and the wars and the military state and so forth. And I think evidence of that is if you go way back to the start of Bush's war in Iraq and 9/11 and all these events, the Federal Reserve kept rates really low and to try to stimulate the stock market and the real estate market and on and on. And he had to finance the war, and he didn't want to pay for it, you know, by raising taxes. So there you go. We're kind of seeing these easy money policies from the Federal Reserve now for quite some time. I mean, of course, the Fed's always inflationary in a certain sense, but I really think things have taken a new level since probably around the year 2000, and certainly since 9/11, and I mean, it's just quite amazing. But one of the things, before we get into the possibility of a bear market, is that at this point, you know, the Federal Reserve started this quantitative easing program of buying treasury bonds and mortgages from banks a couple years ago. And when Bernanke started back in 2009, and he renewed it three times afterwards, he actually said that he wanted to help make the stock market go up, and because he was actually coming under some criticism for doing this, especially as the years went on. Ron Paul was on TV as just one person, but there were other Republicans and even some Democrats that were having questions about this. And he answered those criticisms, and I think it was around 2010 or 2011, writing an editorial in the Wall Street Journal saying this is going to make the stock market go up, and that will make people feel rich and spend more money and help the recovery. And, you know, this day and age, he did accomplish that, I think. He did help make the stock market go up, but I think it's real questionable how much that's really helped the economy. So I think now it's more like the danger is he's created, him and Janet Yellen, his successor, have helped create another bubble in the market. And I say that because the valuations in the stock market are extremely high compared to its history. There's a measurement called the cyclically adjusted P.E. ratio. And the P.E. ratio simply measures the price that someone is paying for earnings when they make an investment. So, for example, if you were to buy a stock for $1 and the company earns 50 cents a share a year in profits, that would mean you're paying two times the earnings. Typically, if you go in the private world and buy like a restaurant or a business or something, someone's going to pay three to five times earnings. In the stock market, historically, it trades 13 to 15 times earnings. Well, the earnings now are at 27, and the only time it's been higher than this is back in 1999 and 1929. So, yeah, that's the testimony of how much the market has gone up.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. You know, I hate to, you know, pretend I'm so smart about this or whatever, because I really only have been paying attention to Ron Paul all this time. But so, and I read Jekyll Island back in the day and whatever. But, you know, as an economist, I'm a great foreign policy guy. I don't know. But it's been apparent enough to me, the bubbles of 99 and the bubble of the George W. Bush years that finally broke in 2000, or I guess late 99 and 2000. But it seems like, as you write in here, people just can't imagine, even though they've lived through the same booms and busts that I've lived through in just pretty short amounts of time, it seems like, right? 8 or 10 years between crashes. And yet they think, all right, you know what, man? Look at the market's never been higher. I couldn't possibly sell now. Now's the time. I ought to be buying more. And I just don't understand how that works. I mean, you refer to CNBC, and I'm sure that they're always looking at Werther or Soda Straw like everybody else, but, it just seems like people would get it that, you know, even if they're not really even exposed to Austrian school economists or anything, that the low interest rates cause, or even if they don't make that connection, that at least there's going to be a really big boom and a really big bust over and over again. And even if they're not necessarily feeling rich, talking about those price earning ratios, looking at some of these graphs that you publish here, it's pretty clear that things are way out of whack and due for a major correction.
Well, there's two things going on in what you're saying. First, I think there's common sense. And most people, you know, if you just talk to a random person, you know, they're not going to believe, oh, the stock market's going up forever, or you know, their earnings and valuations don't matter. You know, if you're at a party or something having a conversation like that with an average person, they're just, you know, they don't aren't that crazy about the stock market or whatever. But it's really the people that are in the market that are become the true believers. And I really think it's really just a narrow segment of the population at this point that's fully invested in the stock market that are really the most bullish of people because, frankly, after 2008, the economy went south and a lot of people simply had to take money out of the market regardless of whether it was going to go up or down. They lost during the bust or they lost their jobs or they got to retirement age and just couldn't afford to take any more risks, and they started pulling money out. And those people, you know, they, some of them have put money back in, but a lot of them haven't, and they're, you know, not necessarily really bullish on the stock market. But it's the people in the market who never got out of it in 2008, never sold, and are convinced that, you know, from that experience that they learned that, you know, the drop really in their minds just lasted a couple months, and they survived it, and they've been rewarded for that. And then you have people who are brand new who just put money in it for the first time, so they didn't experience those drops. I mean, what I'm trying to suggest is people kind of, these people in the market tend to rationalize right. their own investment position, just convince themselves right. that they're right.
Well, in 99, or before, like in 97, I was saying, get out, it's a bubble. And then a friend of mine made hundreds of thousands of dollars after I gave that good advice too early, right? Hang on one second. He lost it all in the crash, by the way. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm me, Scott. I'm talking with Mike Swanson. He wrote The War State. It's really good. You can get it on audiobook, too. And he does wallstreetwindow.com, where he gives investment advice. It's a window into what he's doing. And of course, he explains why he's doing what he's doing. And... So, yeah, like I was saying, back in, like, 1997 or something, I'd read Jekyll Island, so I was going around telling everybody I knew who was in the stock market. Oh, man, it's a giant bubble, don't you see? Look at these price-earning ratios and all of this stuff. It's a giant bubble, don't you get it? And one guy I knew, I remember him telling me, well, since you told me to get out of the stock market, I've made $200,000. So what do you got to say for yourself now, smart guy? And then, of course, it was about 6 months after that he lost. I said all before the break because the music was counting down my clock on me. But not all, but he lost much of it, pretty much all he'd gained in the bubble, at least, in the crash of 99 and 2000. Because, geez, if you're the one making hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars for sitting around watching the numbers move, then... Who wants to sell out, especially, you know, some loudmouth kid telling you what he's so sure because he read Ed Griffin, you know? And but anyway, so it just goes to show that it's hard to predict. You can't really say when, can you, or can you?
Yeah, well, that's right, and that's a good lesson right there. And a problem with saying, well, stocks are cheap or they're not cheap and they're really expensive and it's a bubble – is someone that's bullish in the market will say, yeah, so what? You know, it might go up longer, and they can be right. And last year, I was watching people on CNBC and financial writers basically say, oh, yeah, the stock market is overvalued. This PE is really high, but, you know, it can go up more. And they've been right. But, you know, nothing lasts forever. And the thing I put out the other day, I wasn't necessarily trying to predict exactly when a bear market's going to start, but show people how you can tell when it's starting and not, you know, realize like 6 months later or something, mm-hmm. oh, no, you know, I've just lost half my money or something.
Right.
But to really tell when is it starting, and that's different than trying to predict the moment it's going to happen. And the specific thing I was trying to tell people to look for is when you reach the kind of like a tipping point, when a bull market ends and a bear market starts, is typically what will happen is fewer stocks are going up and driving the market higher, and more stocks are actually already dropping. And when you look in the newspaper or look at the television, you see the three market averages, the Dow, the S&P 500, and the NASDAQ. And that's what everyone pays attention to. But there's, you know, literally 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 stocks that trade on the different stock exchanges in the United States, and several hundred, like, different sectors of the market, like, say, utilities or retail companies or cement companies. And these sectors, the stocks that make them up kind of trade together. And what tends to happen is at the very end of a bull market, right as things are tipping over, there's really just a few sectors and a few stocks that are driving as market averages up while everything else is already acting poorly. And then what will happen is those last things that are doing really well, then they all of a sudden stop doing well and get dragged down of everything else, and the averages go down with them. And then that's when people start to lose money in their fund, you know, the funds that they invest in, and so forth.
So where are we now on that cycle then?
Yeah, well, what's happened is that's actually gotten worse over the past year, very slowly. But it's not yet at a point where, you know, I can say, oh, you know, the bull market's over, the bear market is starting immediately. So, for example, one of the things I look at is the percentage of stock above and below their average price over the past 200 days. And right now that's around 65%. On the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ and the S&P 500. In October, that dipped all the way down to 30% when the market had a drop for a couple weeks. But then it bounced back when the market started going up. But it started to lag, meaning that a year ago, that number was like 80, 90%, and now it's around 65%. So it's gotten a little bit worse, but what'll typically happens right when a bear market starts is that number of stocks will drop down below 50%, down to 40 or 30%, like it did in October. But the market averages will rebound off of some correction, and that won't really go back up. So in the thing I wrote, I should have that happen in 2007, and it actually happened a couple of years ago before that flash crash thing happened too. So if something like that happens over the next couple months, then I would really get really concerned about the stock market possibly entering a bear market for good. But even ahead of that, you know, I've raised cash positions in my account, made changes, and I see nothing wrong with someone who's best in the stock market, you know, taking 10% of the money out and putting it in cash or doing something like that with it just to be safe, you know, after it's gone up so much. Mm-hmm. You can't buy on dips or whatever, even if you're bullish, unless you got some cash to do it with.
All right, now, so this is just Rothbard for Dummies here, because what the hell do I know? But I thought that I remembered learning from him that, well, you know, they'll just keep inflating and inflating and inflating until they realize that, uh-oh, this is really causing a problem. We're creating way too much of a bubble here, or we're leading to widespread, you know, price inflation across the board now, or we're risking that. So now we gotta try to dial it back, and how they always try to let the air out slowly, but that never works. It always pops. But what they do is, and this is how you can tell that you better run for the hills, is, when they start raising the federal funds rate that the banks charge each other for overnight loans. And I remember in 2007 and 8 that, you know, I'm just, you know, not as much of a Mises.org guy. I'm more of a LouRockwell.com guy. And so, I was reading, Gary North was saying, hey, look, everybody, they're deflating. They're contracting the monetary base. They're raising the overnight rate, even though it's just a little bit. That means that the bubble is over. It's coming to an end, you know, sooner rather than later, so protect yourself. And but I guess the implication there, as far as my understanding, the point I'm trying to get to is, I guess my understanding is that if they don't do that and they just keep inflating and inflating and inflating, then they can prolong, they can put off the crash. But maybe that's not right. It'll go ahead and crash anyway just because it's all funny money. It's not really amounting to anything. Or how's that work?
Well, that's the $60,000 question. And what's interesting is, the way the market is now, we've never experienced this type of thing, that what the Federal Reserve is doing, having created these quantitative easing programs. So if you look back at the last bear market that started in 2007, they raised rates about 15 times very slowly over the course of a couple of years, which is what Gary North would have been pointing out. This time, interest rates are zero, and there's talk that they might raise rates two or three times over the next year, do it really slowly. But that's not really a giant rate increase. I'd argue, though, that what they've done, you know, they lowered rates to zero in 2008, and they couldn't lower rates anymore, so they started this quantitative easing thing, did it three times, and they let that expire last year. So I would argue in a certain sense that letting that expire was equivalent of raising interest rates. And the two times previous that that program expired, the market had a 10% correction, and then they panicked and created another money printing program. So that's kind of the argument the bullish people have, is that, oh, if the market falls, they'll just make another program. And in fact, when the stock market had a little dip a few weeks in October, there were rumors that, you know, in a year, if the market continued to drop, they would do this. In fact, someone on CNBC that reports for the Federal Reserve or gets leaks from them, that's what he flat out said. So there is a belief that, yeah, they'll do that again. But the problem is, at some point, that can still not be very effective. And I think back to the year 2000 or 2008, for that matter, too. Because once these bear markets get going, they've lowered rates in those last two, and it didn't stop it. Still had to be to play itself out. And I would argue the same thing would happen in the next bear market, too. So the question I always have for these people that just say, well, they'll just print more money, is how much will it take to make it to stop a bear market when the next one comes?
Well, that's the thing. No, you know, I always see Peter Schiff on TV, and he's always basically hollering that they can't stop QE. They're just going to have to QE forever, and it's still not going to work, and they're completely screwed. They've painted themselves to the edge of the cliff, not just into a corner, but that they don't know how to do anything except keep printing.
Yeah, well, that certainly seems to be the case. And the other thing, too, is I was a few minutes ago talking about stock market bulls rationalizing their decisions by believing things can just go up forever and this and that. Well, the people at the Federal Reserve, they do the same thing. If you read their minutes, you can read transcripts of the meetings they had from 2008, 2007, and in 2000. There's a great book called Greenspan's Bubbles that talks about the transcripts from them and from the back then when Greenspan was there. And he never saw the bubble coming or popping, and he was putting himself, and you know, he reacted to it in a panic around in December 2000, like almost close 10 months after the thing really started to unwind. So they don't really see what's coming either. That's one problem with the stock market is, or financial markets in general. No one can predict what they're going to do, and there's no real it's not like a science. There's no real economics, I don't really think, is a science either. It pretends to be, but it's just people trying to come up with things to convince themselves they know what's happening, and they don't.
Well, speaking of which, everybody ought to subscribe to WallStreetWindow.com. That's our friend Mike Swanson. He's the author of The War State and WallStreetWindow.com. Believe me, I learn a lot reading this stuff, and I think all of you guys will too, and we'll really appreciate it. WallStreetWindow.com. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you.
All right, guys. And I think we're already back from the break, right? I'm really bad at the hard breaks here, aren't I? Oh, no, the ads are still playing. All right. We'll be right back with Jeff Dice in just a sec. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. That's strange. I talked to Ian about that. All right. Hey, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Jeff Deist. He used to work for Ron Paul, was his chief of staff for a long, long time there in his congressional office. And now he runs the Mises Institute at Mises.org. Welcome back. How are you doing, Jeff?
Hey, Scott. I got to say, you're showing your age as a Gen Xer with that Iron Maiden intro. I mean,
I'm at the very youngest edge of the X thing. Yeah, I guess I have to.
You know, millennials don't know what the hell that song is.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Yeah, I guess they probably don't. Do they listen to Agnostic Front? I play some Agnostic Front too.
I think the answer to that is no.
Yeah, no, I'm old. I'm old. I was talking to my dad on the Skype, and he said, "Son, your chin's looking pretty gray there." And of course, he's one to talk. But yeah, I'm joining the club. It's true. Hey, good to talk to you again, Jeff. How are you?
I'm doing great. We're doing great down here in Auburn.
Great. So listen, I got a sneak peek at your article running on LouRockwell.com tomorrow. Is Ross, maybe it's already at Mises.org. Is Ross Ulbricht a libertarian hero? Good question. But first, who's Ross Ulbricht?
Well, he's been in the news quite a bit lately. Just last week he was sentenced, but he was actually convicted back in February of running a what feds call a dark website, a Tor site. So he's the originator, founder, and operator of the Silk Road website, which was used as a form of agorism by a lot of people to do and say and buy a lot of different things.
All right. And so, as you say, he was sentenced, and sentenced to what?
Well, it, unbelievably harsh sentence, sentenced to life in prison without parole for what amounts to basically a bunch of nonsensical federal charges like drug trafficking, money laundering, engaging in the criminal enterprise. I mean, these are all sort of the alphabet soup type charges that prosecutors, federal and state, try to throw at people in the hopes that some of them stick. And this time, unfortunately, stick they did. Unlike your typical drug dealer, however, who might spend 5 or 10 or even 20 years in prison before being paroled, poor Mr. Ulbricht, and when I say poor, he's only 31 years old, God bless him, appears absent having his conviction overturned, appears to be headed to literally spending the rest of his life in a federal prison cell. So it's a sad story and really a tragic story in many ways.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely crazy. So so we understand, I guess, a little bit of background, right? Can you explain the Tor and the dark web and whatever a little bit for people who don't know?
Well, there's a variety of ways to operate online in sites that are not necessarily public or that are so-called dark because they exist on different servers and they aren't, you know, easily accessible by just a general website user, general internet user. Most dark sites use cryptocurrencies or other forms of payment when transactions are conducted amongst users of the site. So what happened with Silk Road was what started as an experiment in what you might be able to do with a dark website unfolded into a bit of an open-air drug market or drug bazaar, if you believe the stories that you read. I don't believe all of them, but it appears beyond any reasonable doubt that a lot of different people were buying and selling and obtaining illegal drugs via the Silk Road website. Now, that in and of itself ought not to bother libertarians, and obviously we don't think, we meaning libertarians, don't think people ought to be put into federal cages for simply going about their voluntary peaceful commerce, and whether that involves drugs or anything else, as long as that's amongst willing, voluntary adult participants, I don't think that it should concern us. But the severity of the sentence and the coupling of Mr. Ulbricht's name and Bitcoin and drug trafficking into sort of an anti-libertarian stew by this awful sentencing judge is something that concerns me and ought to concern all of us who are libertarians, because in a sense, our name is being dragged through the mud in publications like the New York Times.
Well, now, so even beyond, libertarian individualist opposition to drug wars as a policy and that kind of thing, even if you take into account, you know, for the sake of argument, the illegality of heroin, even if you think it should be legal, what if you're one of them law and order types who just say the law is the law and go run for Congress if you want to change it kind of thing? But I believe what you're explaining to me here is that this guy, Ulbricht, he never had heroin on his premises that he was selling to anybody. He built a website, and then other people who he never knew or actually even really came into contact with were selling drugs to each other. And now, so maybe that's illegal, but so is that what they charge him with? Is conspiring with people who he never conspired with to break other laws?
Well, he did have some people he worked with to create and maintain the site. But you're true. I mean, in a sense, it's almost like charging the phone company because two mafiosos get together and use the phone.
Right. Yeah, I saw a comment that said he put the 7-Eleven parking lot online. So what?
Right. And I don't know as a factual matter whether he himself either engaged or held any illegal substances or not. But I think your point is well taken.
But there's no evidence of that. That's not what he was charged with, actually being a heroin dealer in any way.
Not what he was charged with. He was charged with trafficking, but through the operation of his site, not through him personally.
Mm-hmm. Well, and trafficking there being used in a way where it doesn't mean anything anymore. I mean, because trafficking typically would mean what? Like you drove – it was my heroin, but you drove the truck or something like that, right? I mean, he's not actually trafficking.
I don't believe he was, as a factual matter, no.
And I also read that they accused him of hiring hitmen to kill people, but it doesn't sound like that was in any of the charges either. They just kind of accused him of that in the sentencing arguments or what?
We got to understand there's two different things going on here. There's the legal case and what happens to Ross Ulbricht's life as a person. And then there's the court of public opinion. And federal prosecutors don't like liberty. They don't like Bitcoin. They don't like privacy. They don't like internet. So what happened was when he was first charged and arrested, they floated this trial balloon that he had ordered hitmen to go after some people who were mucking about with his website. Ultimately, they never charged him with this, which I guess would be solicitation for murder. He was never charged with this. They've produced what they purport to be some diaries, some journal entries. Well, I don't know why a guy obsessed with privacy would create journal entries that could be later found by law enforcement, but that's what they allege, that in some of these journal entries are supposed to contain the details of him reaching out to hitmen. His mom says that the journal entries don't read like his voice whatsoever, and she's convinced they're totally bogus. Obviously, she's biased. But what I suspect is this is just prosecutors doing what prosecutors do, mm-hmm. which is trying to try people in the court of public opinion. And then later on, they just back away from these bogus charges. And they did. He was ever charged with this.
Well, it sounds like what really upset the judge was the challenge to this government's law more than anything else. That you think that you can do this thing where you just ignore us. We'll show you. We'll make an example out of you.
Yeah, that's absolutely what's at play here. And I wonder, he happens to be a U.S. citizen, but I wonder what the judge's position or what the prosecutor's position would be if the server for his site, the users of his site, and the cross-border activity that took place via his site had occurred totally outside the U.S. I mean, would they still attempt to say Uncle Sam has dominion over all things? I suspect they would. So it's terrible that this guy has gotten caught up in probably what must be the worst justice system in the developed world. Mm-hmm. And as a result, he's going to jail for a long time.
Yeah. Well, and there's an ad that runs here on LRN about supporting him where they point out that, hey, even if he's guilty, he's a hero, man. He made the market that government made a black market safer so that you could just go to your mailbox instead of having to go do business with scary criminals. And so they had to put an end to that, I guess, right away. But it's an important point. All right, well, great article, and thanks for your time, Jeff. Appreciate it.
All right, Scott. Take care.
All right, y'all, that is Jeff Dice. He's the president of the Mises Institute.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Huh. All right, so let's see. In the spirit of George Carlin, here's the war and hostility scoreboard. America's lost in Afghanistan, but still keep the troops there so they don't have to call it lost. But the government can't last without your money and your son's over there fighting for it. In Pakistan, they're still drone bombing from time to time anyway. I don't know. We don't get nearly enough coverage of the state of the drone war there in Pakistan. But presumably they're fighting, you know, against the bin Ladenites there and their allies in Pakistan. We're fighting for the bin Ladenites and their allies against the Houthis, because that's what the Saudis want right now in Yemen. While just across the, is it the Bab al-Mandeb, is that how you say it? That little strait there in the Red Sea, at the opening of the Red Sea. Just across there in Somalia, America is fighting against the bin Ladenites. In Libya, we fought a war in 2011 for the bin Ladenites. Now we switch sides back to the next Gaddafi, basically. This guy Haftar is the kind of half-assed CIA asset over there trying to put a fascist dictatorship together, apparently failing. In eastern Iraq, we're still on the side of the Iranians and the Shiite militias against the bin Ladenites. In Syria, still on the side of the bin Ladenites against the Iranian-backed Baathist regime there. And, you know, I just don't know what the hell's going on in Lebanon. Probably nothing good. I know it's kind of hard to keep track, but that's why all the repetition. Salafists gaining ground throughout the Middle East, thanks to U.S. intervention. That's Dan Sanchez today, a great writer, also from the Mises Institute, like our previous guest, Jeff Dice there. Dan is the head of teaches the Mises Academy there, and he's a really sharp guy, and he's a really great young writer, and is interested in foreign policy and writes great stuff about it. Where do they get those wonderful Toyotas? That's Dan Sanchez today at antiwar.com. That really should just be antiwar.com/Dan. That should be easier. I'm going to talk to Eric about that. I'll fix that. Salafists gaining ground. Also, ISIS moves against Syrian city of Azaz, hoping to control Turkish border. Rival rebels urging U.S. to provide airstrikes to slow the ISIS advance. And, yeah, it was funny reading Roy Gutman and McClatchy today. Rebels call for airstrikes as Islamic State advances. You mean some rebels call for airstrikes against some of the other rebels. That's because they're killing each other. It doesn't mean that the Islamic State are not part of the rebel movement in the civil war against Bashar al-Assad, but you know, Roy, he's very suggestible sometimes. He does good reporting in fine detail, but his understanding of things sometimes is just, I don't know, hilarious? Something. All right. Yeah, so there you go. And they're still fighting in Baiji, too. Here's a new one. Mitchell Prothero in Politico magazine. The Iraqi army is too exhausted to fight. Iraq's army grows smaller by the day. Sectarian militants are picking up the slack. Our friend Mitch Prothero, writing here in Politico magazine. I told you, man, I don't know who's their editor there, but they've had some pretty good journalism in there. I read a good thing about the war on prostitution in Politico magazine this morning, too, written by a Reason writer. New federal incentives for local cops to go round up local whores and pretend like they're busting international child trafficking organizations and a bunch of crap. Ridiculous. Anyway, it's an interesting article. You should read it, man. It's good stuff. It's about the economics of politics, as Obi-Wan Kenobi calls it. The Iraqi army too exhausted to fight. Mitch Prothero, he was on the show explaining to us how, well, see, there is no Iraqi army, really. The only thing that's left of it that's actually any kind of fighting force are basically their Rangers. I don't think you could compare any of their teams to, like, top-tier special forces. They got second-tier special forces there, the Rangers. They're the Golden Dawn or the various SWAT teams, they call themselves. Ahem. SWAT teams. But these guys have had it, man. They try to run and put out fires, but they can't stay and occupy anything. I haven't read this yet, but I already know the song he's singing here, because we talked to him, what, 2 weeks ago? And here's the only bit of good news on our plate today, I guess. Islamic State campaign as unpopular as Iraq offensive before the 2007 surge, which, as we covered on the show in recent days, was only popular because of a giant PR campaign, not because of anything good that happened. Americans are dissatisfied with the U.S. military campaign. See, you know, this goes back to Neil Postman. I know, it's the only smart guy book I ever read, okay? Leave me alone. Neil Postman talked about how, well, all technologies are double-edged swords. And, you know, it's like a Heisenberg uncertainty principle thing. You measure something, you change it by measuring it. It makes the measurement difficult, kind of a sort of a metaphorical kind of a simile. So, the point is, they ask questions like, are you dissatisfied or are you satisfied with the war? And by asking the question that way, they define the answers in a certain way. It'd be just as easy to say, do you think we should be doing more, or do you think we should be doing less, or do you think it's just about right? Right? Something like that. But instead, are you happy or not? And then any side gets to spin it how they want. Well, no, I don't think the war's going well at all. Well, so what do you think should happen? We should forget it? Because it's the war that made it this way, and so how could more war make it better? Come on. Or are you saying that you're upset that Barack Obama doesn't have a Lindsey Graham foreign policy? Because you know that's what Lindsey Graham's going to say this says. Oh, yeah, no, the American people are dissatisfied. Why? Well, we're merely bombing them. When we should be sending tens of thousands of ground troops, that's what Fred Kagan says. Admittedly, he also says, quote, it is impossible to articulate a clear path to the desired end state. But still, give me your son, he says. He won't be going. He'll be, give him to that general over there, he says. But so the polls are almost worthless. 44% say they blame Obama's policies for the problems in Iraq. 43% blame Bush. Well, why do I have to say or? The question is it Bush or Obama? You stupid idiots. George Bush created Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Barack Obama turned it into the Islamic State. There, it's 100% both their faults. In fact, each of them is more responsible than Omar Baku al-Baghdadi, the so-called caliph. And how do you like that, pollster? But you're not taking that down. That wasn't on the multiple choice. It wasn't a multiple choice. Oh, it was. It was. They did have both. I'm such a stupid idiot sitting here ranting. Both or neither is one of the answers. You get to choose. Both or neither, 11%. So that still doesn't tell us anything, though. Most are saying neither, or most of those are saying both. Anyway, I suck at this, but I'm still right. But, you know, I don't know, man. It doesn't really matter what the American people think anyway, does it? No, of course it doesn't. By the way, Saudi warplanes pound Sana'a, killing at least 8 civilians. Strikes on military depots set off explosions near residential areas. This is Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com covering the Yemen war. And it's America's war there in Yemen. It's our planes and our ships and our intelligence guys picking all the targets. Although presumably it's Saudis doing the flying. I don't really know that that's even true. All right, anyway. C-SPAN 2, back to the Freedom Act. See you tomorrow, guys.